From the Spec Network, this is Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to the show.
This episode of Fragmented is sponsored by our friends over at Cobiton. So you may ask, who is Cobiton? Cobiton is a company that wants to empower mobile developers. Your next question might be, well, how is Cobiton trying to do that? Let me ask you, what's the one thing that's super painful to do today as an Android developer or any mobile developer? Testing on real devices, right? We're big fans of testing here, and testing on real devices is kind of hard to do on Android. Just the other day when I was at work, I got reports of a crash on this really specific device. It was a Samsung Galaxy A7. I wanted to run our automated test suite on this device, you know, just to make sure everything was well. But you know what? It was hard to do because, I mean, I'm quite happy with my Pixel. I'm not going to buy a Samsung Galaxy A7 device. But thankfully, Cobiton actually has this device in their test lab. And it's really pretty awesome. You should give it a shot to see how the actual experience works. You can test your mobile app on actual real devices, and it's almost like you have this device lab arsenal on the go. You can spin up your tests while sitting at a nice coffee shop outside. It's summer here. That's not a bad idea. Launch all those tests on that random device, and boom, you're done. They do both manual and automated tests, which is what is really cool. If your company has a QA department or, you know, just anyone wants to run manually some tests, they can do that too. Instead of you buying an actual Galaxy A7 device and handing it over to them, instead, just send them over a Cobiton subscription. That would work even better because then they have access to a whole suite of devices where they could run their UI tests, their automated tests, your manual tests, everything. Their monthly plans start at as low as $10 a month, which is pretty cool. And there's no annual commitment. So if at any point you want to cancel this, well, you're free to do that. So visit cobiton.com/fragmented to start your 15-day free trial and check all the cool stuff that they have there. Thanks again to Cobiton for sponsoring today's show. In this episode of Fragmented, Don and I decompress a little. We kick it off by discussing the recent Reddit AMA that was done with the Android engineering team that are working on the upcoming O release. We discuss some of the points that we thought were interesting and other noteworthy points that came out of this AMA. From there, we drift a little and talk about other day-to-day Android development stuff, like how we organize our code in our repositories, our testing strategy, and how we have started to think about testing these days in Android. So listen on to find out more.
Okay, Kaushik, so you went to what conference recently and spoke?
So I was recently at this wonderful conference called 360 and Dev, and this is basically in Denver. And I must say, this was my first time in Denver, and Denver is really cool.
It has, yeah, it's like, pretty cool.
It's a really cool scene there, and like there are like some amazing developers. 360 and Dev is organized by two people who we actually know from the show and who have come and spoken to us. This is Chuki and Dave Smith, also known as Devon Wired.
Yeah, Dave works at Google now. From what I remember, he's the IoT developer advocate now.
Yeah, that's right. He was the one who came and like taught us about the Bluetooth stuff in a previous episode, which is also pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. I'll have to link that up in the show notes. So if folks are interested, take a listen there.
Yeah, and Chuki's ex Google, so a lot of Google like mana going there.
Do you know if those talks were recorded?
They are recorded, and they're done by our good friends at Realm, who do an exceptional job usually with those recordings. You know, I actually was a little worried because I was like, you know, I usually go with developer t-shirts and stuff, and I was like, whoa, Realm is recording this. Like, you know, maybe I should wear like something a little more, you know, presentable. But in the end, I was like, it'll be fine.
Cool. So we can expect to see your talk online, and that should be pretty interesting.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, I'll definitely like post the link when it's out. It was fun. I talked about multicasting in RxJava. I've been doing like the RxJava by example series before, and yeah, this time I talked about multicasting. So, and like some of the other talks were amazing. Like, you know, almost every single one of them. Like, you know how when you're in certain good conferences, sometimes it becomes a little tricky because you don't know which one to go to because all of them are so good. That was definitely my only problem with 360 and dev. Like, I just couldn't for the life of me decide. So I just had to flip a coin every time, like, go and check.
I was talking to a mutual friend, Matt Logan, yesterday, and he was telling me the same thing. He said, you know, there was all these talks that were going on at the same time that there's just no way that you could go to them all at once, of course, because you're going to be at one place at one time. And it was just, so he's really looking forward to the videos coming out, and I'm sure everybody else is too.
Oh, yeah. And Matt also spoke, so it was yep. fun catching up.
So today we were going to just kind of have another one of our episodes where it's just you and I kind of talk about a couple of things. And so here we are. One of the things that recently happened was the Android team AMA on Reddit. Now, I wasn't actually even present for this. I was heads down coding all day. Were you there at all? Did you participate in the AMA or what did you learn, if you were, or if anything of that?
Oh, yeah, sure. So the thing is, I didn't necessarily participate in that. I wasn't there when it actually happened live. But I did definitely go back and like have a look at some of the posts. And it was like fascinating. This is like the actual Android engineering team. Mm-hmm. They came to do like an AMA. And for folks who don't know what AMA on Reddit is, it's basically like ask me anything, right? So you get a chance to like literally ask anything. I mean, obviously, some of the questions may not necessarily be answered. So it was fascinating. And I thought like, yeah, let's maybe like, these are some of the things that struck me as interesting. Obviously, yeah. Different people would find different other things interesting. But I thought, hey, like, I'll just like discuss some of the things that I thought were pretty cool.
Like, if you were to say, what's one of the ones that like, straight off the top of your head that really kind of popped out to you that was really interesting?
Diane Hackmorn, like she's obviously like a very well-respected Android engineer and one of like the key engineers responsible for like making Android what it is today.
Yeah.
There was one I remember where like someone asked like a seemingly regular question. So what was the question? It was, oh, when I have a scheduled network request job, right? Should I be using Job Scheduler now or should I be like, you know, using the Alarm Manager? Which is, that's like a question that you would typically see like usually. And like, you know, I thought like, oh, this is like one of those questions. But it's always interesting when when the source is someone like who works on the Android framework, right? Because I was like, oh, what do they think about this, right?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, as most folks know, like the third-party developer community has sometimes like different ideas and approaches to how Android is, to like developing in Android versus like the Android core framework team, right? Because, and rightfully so, because the expectations are different.
Yep.
Right. So, I mean, the TLDR, like, and I would like, we'll make sure to drop a link in the show notes to all of these, to all of these resources and to the AMA. And folks should definitely read it. But the TLDR is essentially, there were two answers, if I remember right. One was, you can totally use Alarm Manager for that. But then Diane Hackborn came back and said, oh, like, it depends on what's important to you, right? Like, so there's like the question of time priority, which is like, do I absolutely need to execute this job at that specific time? And because the question that was asked was a network request, she said, well, there's also the element, like, I would typically, while you would use an Alarm Manager, I would also seriously consider the Job Scheduler because there are two factors. One is the time constraint, and the other is like the availability of network, right? So what would happen if, because Alarm Manager would just say, okay, execute no matter what at this yep. specific time, right?
Totally.
But there's no guarantee that you would have a network, you would have network connectivity at that point, right? So she said Job Scheduler, on the other hand, allows that in some ways, right? Like Job Scheduler allows you to like check for network connectivity. So you could, if both of those, the combination of both of those were important, as would be in the case of a scheduled network job, then, like, you know, Job Scheduler makes sense. And I thought that was interesting. Like, you know, it's something that you might inherently do, but like when it was like actually verbalized that way in a succinct way, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I read up on that one as well. And after everything was over and said and done, of course. And it was interesting that she said that if you're going to, you can still use Alarm Manager. It's just, it's a very rare use case in which you actually need to use Alarm Manager because Alarm Manager, as you said, will... Right. Hey, this happened, go do something. And the app will just go do it. And it's in a very rare instance when your app may have not even been used today at all, where you need it to go do something at this very moment, regardless of anything else happening on the device. So that's kind of the very, you know, rare use case. But there are instances where you may need it to happen. Perhaps you're building some type of health app for, you know, diabetes or something like that. And you have to check something. You have to notify the user. It is like, you know, imperative, critical that this happens. So there are those use cases. But for the most case, using job scheduler and, you know, allowing yourself to check for network activity if you need that network request is going to be key. It's also interesting too that there's, you know, we have Job Scheduler, we have Alarm Manager, and then we have all these other third-party libraries that are out there that can kind of, you know, default and fall back accordingly depending upon your SDK level that you're supporting too. And that's not been brought up because that's a huge edge case of depending upon your exact app and your use case.
Right. Yeah. And like for the folks, like I think some of the libraries you're mentioning are Priority Job Queue. That's the one by Eat when he was over at Path. And the other one is the Evernote one. I keep always getting this name wrong. It's One Job, Android Job. One. Oh, Android Job. Okay.
Yeah, Android Job.
So close.
Yeah. So they're all done some pretty cool stuff. But it's very cool that the Android team has actually provided a little bit of comments and guidance on when to use it, because it's hard to figure out when, especially when you're someone new to the platform, which one you should be using.
Oh yeah, for sure. And they have a pretty good sense of humor too. Like some of the responses were kind of interesting. For example, there was one user who asked this question, who invented the Fragment Manager and Backstack? Like, I want names. Do they have a PhD in chaos theory or something?
I see that, yes.
It was good. And like the Android engineering team, they responded saying, we've put those people in witness protection program and we cannot reveal names. But so it was good. It was nice to see that, like, you know, it's very real, right? Like these are real human beings working on something, and it's like nice to get responses on each of them.
Yeah, the Fragment thing is funny. It's
We recently had some Twitter conversations about it, right?
Yeah. So I mean, let's just hop on that for just a quick second.
Yeah.
I think the question was somewhere around, you know, should I be using, if I'm building an app, should I be using Fragments or should I be using something like, custom views or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
I think that was what it says. And my initial response is like, hey, I still use Fragments every single day.
Right.
I will probably continue to use Fragments. Again, I have to approach it differently than a full-time employee at a company where I am the manager or the lead. I'm a consultant. I show up, I build stuff, and then I eventually leave. So I have to make sure that it's maintainable and familiar to people. So I choose to use Fragments. From what I remember, you still use Fragments, or has that changed?
I don't use Fragments anymore. I mean, I don't recall. I mean, again, this is like one of those things that have changed, but I'm like pretty much in the same boat as you, right? Like there are some times, I mean, again, you optimize for what is like the right and convenient thing to do at that point, right? Which, I mean, like, I know that's like, it gets a little tricky. And like, you know, these answers are usually not like the best answer, but like, sure, it depends, right? Like, there are some places like dialogue fragments in view pagers where like Fragments are just the way to go, right? Like, it's so easy to do that. Sure, I could potentially use other alternatives and custom views, but sometimes, like, you know what, if it works and like people know how it works, maybe that's just like the way to go, right? So, but I mean, I have swayed in the opposite direction, where given a preference, I choose to like usually not use Fragments. I use like an activity, single activities, like that's how you like I go. But that's mostly because I feel it's simple, right? Like and we have discussed this. Like I am very okay with verbosity, right? Like in the sense that like I don't mind repetition. Like I am very okay with repeating myself, right? Until I truly feel the need to like abstract stuff. So
yeah.
Along those lines, I mean, I definitely still use Fragments here and there, but I choose to use activities by and large because I just like dealing with one life cycle.
You have multiple activities though, right? Or do you have one activity for your whole app?
Oh, no, sorry. Multiple activities. Like if I have like an activity per screen, if that makes
sense. Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure. At first I was confused. I thought you were just had one activity and that was your entire app and you were just doing some like view magic. Kind of like, I think, Flow and Mortar style.
Right. I have tried that in the past, but like, again, the thing is like only the person who initially builds that app finds that convenient. Like your colleagues will slowly start to hate you and curse you as time goes. So Yeah. No, no, definitely. I don't have just a single activity.
Interesting. Cool. Cool. So, and on that, on the AMA, I'm still digging through it. I mean, if folks, when you get here, you'll see that it's, you know, many scrolls long. Mm-hmm. So I still haven't dug it through all of it, personally myself. Did you see anything else in there that was pretty cool?
So, I mean, we've been talking about the good things. There were some things that I did find a little disheartening.
Uh-oh, here we go.
bring on the cavalry, right? I'm not sure if you've noticed this. So previously, right, on iOS, one thing that I've heard that it's relatively easier to do, again, I haven't built iOS apps, so I don't know, but this is like what I hear, like, you know, the water cooler talk with my colleagues. Like, it is possible to detect when the keyword has come up, right? This is not necessarily something that you can do in Android, right? Like, in Android, you give instructions saying, hey, open keyboard or, like, dismiss keyboard, right?
Yeah.
You don't necessarily get a live stream of events, or you don't exactly know that, hey, keyboard is opening right now, so, you know, you can do stuff. And I think somebody asked that, because, like, this is, like, a very common complaint among many Android developers, right? Like, hey, like, can, like, the soft keyboard, can, like, we need, like, more APIs around it, right?
Yeah.
But there is, like, the concern about, like, security, because obviously if you have more APIs in the keyboard, like, that's, like, your primary mechanism of input, right? And I think it was Diane Hackborn who replied. I'm trying to quickly...
It was, yep.
Yeah, okay. I see it. Yeah, yeah, there we go. So, and she mentioned, like, no, we don't necessarily have any significant plans. I mean, that was, like, an answer that I was not necessarily very happy with. I mean, obviously, like, they did say, like, oh, if you have suggestions, like, you should... like, bring it up and tell us what to do. But, I mean, that was just, like, one thing. It just makes me feel like, oh, like, you know, this is a complaint that we've had, but it's, like, never, like, been thought. It's not on the priority list, right? And, I mean, I totally understand why. It's just that, like, you know, sometimes when you want to build, like, this super rich user experience, it becomes a little tricky on Android, right?
It does, yeah. I can't tell you how many times I've encountered a situation with the keyboard popping up, and then my view just kind of doing some funky things, or I need to do something else because the keyboard's popped up. I need to scroll the view. I need to get something back right into focus.
Right.
And it's just every time it's like a test of wills of like, okay, here I go again. And
right.
This is one of those things too. This happens a lot on Android for me. I will develop something. I run into a weird platform situation like this soft keyboard mm-hmm. thing we're talking about now. I'll figure out how to get it to work. And I'm like, oh, finally, I'll commit the PR, gets approved, it goes on. And it goes just long enough where I forget what I did, and then yeah. I got to do it again.
Oh my God, that is so true. That happens all the time. Yeah, yeah.
Like, I need to create a something like so I can just continually have space repetition learning so I can continue to remind myself just where I'm starting to forget it, then I get reminded, hey, don't forget. just one
Don,
of those things.
We have these things called blogs, and you should write more blog posts.
You are correct. I actually haven't written any blog posts in a while. I got to do that again.
Yeah, you're pretty active like in the past, right? So yeah, you got to get on that, man.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of videos, so it's been.
That's true. No, I obviously joke. Like you've been doing like a crazy amount. Not like sometimes I'm even surprised how you manage to do it all. So with the keyboard API, there was another thing that was interesting from that. Like she did mention like many of the times, like these APIs are dependent on the actual implementation of IME itself. And that's something that I sort of picked up later. Like it makes sense in hindsight, but I never thought about it. So IME, for those who have actually like played with the keyboard APIs, is like something that's very inherently relevant to it. We're not going to go into the details because that's like a topic in itself. But yeah, that was something that I picked up that I thought was interesting.
Yeah, there's so much good stuff in here. Like there's a question by someone here who asked why you couldn't implement the nightlight on Nexus 6P.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That one. Yeah, yeah.
That was interesting. And Roman Gee replied basically saying that the nightlight required a different implementation of the hardware abstraction layer used by the window compositor. So that completely have no idea where that's at in the Android ecosystem, but that's what it was needed, and it wasn't inside of the 6P. So it's interesting. That's actually a feature I'm really looking forward to because I actually don't own a Pixel.
Oh, yeah,
6P. That's
right. Yeah.
I am a long-time user of Flux. Are you a user of Flux at all?
Oh, yeah, yeah. On my laptop and like before like they came, it came natively on like the mobile devices. Like, yeah, I would totally, yeah.
Yeah, there's a... For folks that aren't aware, Flux is a OS X tool, and I think there's probably an equivalent on Windows and probably Linux too. But what it does is it analyzes your location in the world using, you know, you tell it where it's at. Mm-hmm. And then based upon when you tell it, hey, I normally go to sleep at 11 o'clock at night. At that point in time, it'll kind of reverse, calculate when the actual, you know, the blue light on your monitor should be adjusted. And what it tries to do is remove that blue light as much as possible. And the first few times you start using it, it's kind of weird because my wife especially, she'll walk in and be like, what is wrong with your screen? Because it'll be 9 o'clock at night and my screen looks like completely like orange reddish.
Right.
And I'm like, what are you talking about? There's nothing wrong with it. And she's like, no. And then I'll do something and I can't see something. I'm like, oh, that's right. Let me turn off Flux for a few seconds so I can look at it. And then I'm blinded for like 35 seconds. But long story short, it's supposed to help you with your sleep patterns and just makes life a little easier on your eyes. So we'll put a link in the show notes for that. But anyway, Android, the newer versions, has something very similar to that. So I can't wait to see that. Do you use it on your Pixel?
I do. It's called night mode or something, right? Night mode or night display.
Night light. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, well, definitely. I have that turned on all my devices. Especially we tend to, you know, sort of like stay up for the late hours of the night. And sometimes that's not always a good thing, especially for you, right? With that time difference when you have to like speak to me or something. You're like, oh my God, this guy at 11 p.m. at night.
So I actually go to bed pretty early. I go to bed between right around 10 o'clock. I try to go to bed because I get up at 5.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So like I have learned my optimal sleep pattern is I need a minimum of 7 hours. And as I've said before, that's kind of my, I always call it the secret weapon to anybody is just get more sleep. So it's interesting that it does help out for normal work because I may work late into the evening and I'll still be able to go to bed on time. But when I do speak to you for recordings at 9:30 at night, what I actually do is I do the inverse. I turn it off because I get tired if I don't turn it off. So I turn it on. It actually wakes me up.
Oh.
And then by the time we're done recording, I'm already exhausted probably. And so I can just turn it off, a few minutes, have some tea, and I'm out.
Oh, so that's the secret. That's how you're so energetic when we speak. You have Flux turned off. Okay. No.
Otherwise, you hear me snoring.
Yeah, there's like this guy. Cool. On the topic of displays, I think there was another one that I thought was interesting. So folks who follow like the tech land, right? Like Apple announced like for their iPads or something, this 120 hertz refresh rate. So have you heard about this at all?
No, this is the first time I've heard it.
Okay, so basically what Apple did is like one of the announcements that they made for the iPad, if I recall correctly, they've changed, like, so typically the refresh rate on screens is 60 hertz, right? What they did is they upped that. So they made it to 120 hertz. And what basically, again, we're not going to go into too many of those details because A, I'm also not completely aware of how like the hardware works. But essentially with the refresh rate being bumped up, your latency goes down, right? So like the screen refreshes way more faster. Basically, you tend to see that it's way more smoother. So if you're scrolling or if you're like using if you're switching between windows, it's so fast that your eye doesn't catch like that moment when like the pixels like change, right? It's so fast. So, and this was like, I haven't actually used any of these. I haven't seen how they work, but apparently like the folks who do have said that it's like a game changing thing, right? Like it's so smooth and it like works amazingly well. Obviously it requires a way more powerful processor.
Yeah.
And so I think someone, as is the case with most of these Android questions, if you've attended like a fireside chat, right, folks say, oh, like, you know, Apple has done this. Like, does Google have any plans to do something like this, right? And I think, again, it was like Romain Guy, who's like the resident all things display and color on Android. He mentioned like, actually, I didn't have any idea of this. Like the Sharp apparently had a phone before that did this exact same thing way back when, right? So, and apparently, like, it was amazing even when they did that. So it's definitely on their minds, but it isn't necessarily something that's, like, made the priority list yet. So that'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, it's Tim Murray, which is also, as he says here, he's one of the other folks who cares a lot about touch latency. Mm-hmm. He says he wants it. And the key thing that really resonates with me here is he said that Romain showed him the Sharp phone. And he said it ruined him too. which I think the best way to really relate what they probably mean here, because talking about hertz over an audio podcast is probably like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, that is true.
Imagine the time that when you were working on your MacBook or whatever, your laptop, and you're normal, and then you finally upgraded your laptop and you got a Retina one, and you got that Retina display, and all of a sudden, like, all the fonts just looked a lot better.
Yeah.
Like, everything just looked like, it looked like someone had just like wiped the screen clean for you. You're like, whoa, I've been looking through this dirty film this entire time. That's kind of the same feeling that you get when you bump up those hertz rates, because it's just like this whole other feeling that you're like, whoa. And then you kind of go back to your regular device. You're like, oh, man.
The trick, I guess, with these, though, is like if you have to refresh the screen that fast, like you probably need like way more powerful, like, you know, GPUs, I imagine, or like, you know, you need more, way more powerful phones. So I imagine that like might eat into battery life as well. So yeah. I'm not sure. Like, yeah, I'm sure like the folks on Android are like figuring this out.
Good old batteries.
I know, right? Always the bane of our existence. We need smaller batteries, but way more powerful batteries.
So we had talked previously, kind of over chat here, about some of the things that we have been noticing inside of the Android world for a while. And one of those things that is a conversation that pops up on each team and is eventually always going to happen, and will happen continually, is how do you organize your code?
Oh, yeah.
And that's something that has changed for me over the years. And what I mean by that is are you putting everything just in one package and you have like 8,000 files in there, which if you are, please don't do that. Or are you putting things, packaging everything, you know, kind of per layer of your application, meaning like, hey, all my activities go in this folder and all my fragments go in this folder and all my view stuff goes in here. Do you do it like that? Which I've done that too. Mm-hmm. Or are you packaging it by feature and so forth? So, and there's even also other methods here we'll get into as well. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of a conversation I wanted to bring up here, and it's something that I know you're interested in. So let me ask you first, how do you package your, you know, how do you organize your code for your Android projects? Are you kind of a feature by feature, or are you more layered, or do you have something completely different that you use?
Again, this is like something that's evolved for me. This is something that I never found the right words for, right? Like, I didn't know it was actually called packaging by feature versus layer. But eventually what I've gravitated towards is packaging by feature, right? Mm-hmm. And this thing is a little tricky because usually when you start a brand new Android project, you don't have too many files, right? So at that point, packaging by layer tends to make sense, right? Like, totally. Because you're like, oh, all my activities go here. Like, all my database classes, my model classes go here. Everything is just like, it doesn't make sense at that point to like start packaging by feature, but rather by layer seems to make more sense, right? But I've quickly learned that packaging by feature has like worked out just better for me, right? You know, in terms of simplicity, even if you just have one feature, eventually if your app becomes like big enough, like you're going to have more than one feature, right?
Yeah.
So when that happens, it is a very nice transition. What that does mean, though, it seems like it's like duplicating stuff. Like, it seems like oh, wait, like I have activities across all packages. And like, you know, sometimes it's nice if you want to maintain all of them in the same package. And I'm saying package in quotes here, like, you know, with the Java package. So you have access across, like you have the protected access across all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I've learned that packaging by feature, like eventually is just like worked out better for me, right? A, it's cleaner. B, it just seems like it's isolated, right? So in some ways, it sort of inherently puts a constraint in my mind saying, wait, is this really belonging in this feature? Am I trying to like, you know, leaking functionality across like different places? Like maybe this should be like encapsulated within just this package, right? Like, do I truly need this to be shared across multiple places? I found that packaging by feature has like been pretty beneficial for me so far. Well, what are your thoughts? Because like you did mention like the other thing, which is packaging by module, which I think is a very new and interesting thing, right? So is that something that you've been doing? What have you been using?
So the quick Writer's Digest of my packaging kind of standards of what I've been doing through Android, my ecosystem of Android. Like I said before, I started off previously just doing everything by layer. And what that means is I would put all my activities in, you know, whatever, an activity folder, all those kind of things. And that worked until, you know, we got up until it's a couple projects I was on. We, you know, you get to 30, 40 screens, all of a sudden things aren't making sense. Like, okay, what folder is that in again? Do I put that over here, or does that belong over in this other? Does it belong in folder X or folder Y? And like, you kind of start having these weird things like, where do we put all these weird things? And sometimes you would have like a feature that required a class that did something for you. It maybe acted as a facade to talk to other services. And like, you really don't have a facade folder. Mm. So do you create a facade folder just for that? Kind of, but then it kind of seems like a waste. And at this point, you may feel like it's splitting hairs, and it kind of does feel like that. And I especially feel like that since I'm inside of IntelliJ, you know, Android Studio like you are, and I use the code search all the time. Like, if I know that I'm going to look for the login activity, I just command O login activity. I go straight to it. If I want to know where it's at, I use the keyboard shortcut Alt F1 Enter, and it will take me directly to where that file is located in the file structure, in the project structure. So to me, I find that I really don't rely on the project structure that much when I'm navigating it, because if I'm familiar with the application. However, just like anything in life, if you keep everything organized, you can help kind of find it a little bit easier. That said, I've migrated from that to a completely feature-driven packaging. So very much like you, put things inside of features, which to me, it's much more logical now, because if I have that weird facade layer for that one feature, mm-hmm. I can just drop it inside of that, you know, login folder, if that's for the login feature or whatever. And I know that it's in there. If I have if I need three different adapters for these couple of screens, because I'm doing some crazy stuff with recycler views, they go in there and I don't have to worry about it polluting anything else like that. But that's worked very well for me. I think the important thing to note though about the package by feature is like, all right, well, what do you do about shared components? Well, at that point, you can have a folder that is just shared, because you are going to have a few things that are shared. Maybe it's something like some views that you're going to put all over your application, and those might just need to be in a shared views folder. You may have something that's related to handling strings or something like that for your particular application, put it there. And you may have stuff related to network, and that may go in its own network folder or whatever. So that's useful. Now, you did bring up modules. I have seen, and we spoke to Gotham, who works at Uber.
Oh, yeah.
And at that time, he said, please correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know if it was 70 or over 170. Yeah,
it was basically what seemed like an inhuman amount of modules. There was like, I was like, wow, that is like bonkers.
And so what they were doing is starting to organize their code into reusable modules itself. So actual Java modules or whatever modules are going to be using, Android modules. And then they pull that into their application. And I've seen that done now at a few companies. And this can be either just pulled into a module and that's where it is, and you include that inside of your application. And then you even take it a step further, where people will develop these modules kind of, you know, in their own little silo. And then they'll push them up to some local Artifactory server, and then they'll pull them down through Gradle that way. And the reason for this is a lot of times you're going to have if you are a larger company and you have multiple applications that all kind of have some shared components between them, you want to share that code, you want a way to do that. And usually the best way to do that is going to be able to put these in some type of module, push them up to a repository like Artifactory, and then you can consume them in many different applications without having too much problems and too much churn.
Yeah. I mean, you brought up some excellent points, and I basically want to follow up on some of them, because I think it's easy to miss, because you mentioned this off passing, but these are super thoughtful points that just that makes a lot of sense. So I want to bring these up again. So with respect to the modules, you're absolutely right, right? This is something that folks have been doing. I think two things have sort of encouraged the advent of packaging my module, at least specifically on Android these days. One is and we talked to Zara in a previous episode about this, right? With instant apps, right? If you start packaging by module, I think instant apps just becomes a little easier, because you've already put in what is, I think, the biggest effort in building instant apps, right? Which is the whole module, package by module thing. So folks should listen to the previous episode if you want to get a little more context into why that makes sense for instant apps, right? That's one thing. And the other thing that I feel has encouraged it is recent versions of Gradle. And I might be getting these version numbers wrong. Maybe it's Gradle 4, I think, right? 4 and AGP, the Android Gradle plugin 3 point something. don't quote me on those numbers, but the most recent versions of like Gradle and the Android Gradle plugin today heavily optimize on modules, right? So like basically, if you have like, it's become more intelligent about not recompiling modules that have truly not been touched, right? So that's like a huge benefit that you get if you use packaging by modules. So that's like also another reason people are like being encouraged to move towards this model, right?
Yeah, totally. I'm trying to Google the graph right now, but there was a graph that I think Xavier put out, and it was basically showing, look, here's a project with like 75 modules. And this, I'm just guessing the number. And here's how it built on the previous version of Gradle. And like the build time was just astronomical.
Right.
And then here's the new version of Gradle. And it's just a fraction of what it was before. And so this is actually a real problem in that a lot of folks face, that or these large companies like Uber. And, you know, I can imagine a bunch of other companies that have it too. That have all these modules that just slow down. And so this new improvements inside of the Gradle ecosystem is just tremendous, because then it allows you to break apart these things in modules. It's not going to affect your build time. You're not going to be surfing Reddit for 35 minutes while your build completes.
Yeah.
And you'll be able to get more stuff done. And then also, like you said, you can actually start utilizing things like instant apps and, you know, code reuse and all that good stuff that comes with that.
I have an experimental branch. I didn't want to push this into master yet, at least at Instacart, like where I work, because like, you know, the new Gradle versions, I think, require the latest Android Studio 3.0, which is like right now only in Canary, right? So it's like not entirely sensible or fair to expect everyone to upgrade to the Canary build right now. But yeah, I have like an experimental branch where I've like made, like, you know, I've like migrated all of our changes like to the latest Gradle build system. Because like this is something that always interests me, right? Like build times, I'm like, yeah, I want to get that build time as close as possible to my web development days, which is like almost impossible. But like, hey, it doesn't hurt to try, right?
That's the truth.
So that, I mean, I've already seen improvements. So like, I'm super excited. And like, we're not even that big. Like, we probably have like, I would say 3 or 4 modules at max at this point, like not more than that. So we don't have like 20 or 30 or like 70 modules. So I imagine like as we start moving towards that, that'll become better as well, right?
Yeah.
So packaging by module, definitely, like that's like what, that's the direction that I'm seeing a lot of like apps move towards. You brought up 2 other points that I thought was very interesting, right? Like, and this is stepping back a little with the whole packaging by feature. One thing I think that's super valuable is like the cognitive load, right? Like you said, like with the facade, like, oh, where do I put this? And these are things that like may not seem like a big sort of like deal, but they are very important, right? Like when you have someone contributing to the code base, when you have new developers, when you have developers who are also helping out by contributing to like contributing features to the app, if you have it structured well, right, and you make those decisions like easier, like, oh, where do I put this? Does this go in like the activities folder? Does this go in the feature folder? When you make that easy, that's a huge and tremendous benefit. Like, it's one of those things that people don't immediately think is valuable, but like on the long run is super valuable, right? And so that's, I actually think packaging my feature makes it even more easy, because in that case, right, if you're working on this feature, like it's kind of obvious, right? Where do you put it? It doesn't matter. You just put it inside this feature, right?
Yeah, you're right.
So that's one thing that I think is beneficial, like the cognitive load, reducing the cognitive load.
I was going to say, the cognitive load is such a humongous thing. I highly recommend that folks try to do one thing at one time. Like, there's a lot of science saying that you can't do multiple things at once. Like, you just won't do them all correctly.
Multitasking is a myth, right?
It's totally is a myth. Like, you need to really just buckle down and do one thing at a time. And by removing one additional thing of like, all right, where does this stuff go? Like, that's just so much easier to have to not worry about.
So the cognitive load is one thing. And the other thing that you mentioned, right, is like, oh, if you have like this facade for something, like, you know, where do I put it? Do I put it like in, I don't have a facades directory or something, right? So do I put it there? Or, and I, that brought up an interesting point, I thought, right? When you have, and this is like very common, right? It's easy to say, oh, package everything by feature and like be done. But those features are not independent. Like you rightly pointed out, obviously there exists shared functionality where you'll have to access different features from different feature folders, so to speak, right? But I I thought that was also interesting because what that does is it sort of like forces you to also rethink about APIs, right? For example, it if does. There's truly something that needs to be shared, right? And I'm thinking about our own like repository or like sometimes when you have like the order service, right? Like for example, if you're like working on an app that does deliveries, obviously the delivery object and the delivery service is going to be something that's used all across the app, right? So in that case, it actually makes sense because if you had like, if you use like a common API internally, and when I say API, it's like an internal sort of thing to the application, right? So we have like this delivery service object, and we are very conscious about the APIs that are like exposed out of these, right? Because that is truly the things that you expect the other feature packages to call into, right? Yes. So you know that's like where, like that's the entry point into this feature, right? And it also sort of like forces you to be clean with your API. So that way, other feature packages are not like basically accessing like the other classes left and right, right? Like you don't want direct access to these things all over the place. You want to be a little more thoughtful about how you expose those APIs internally, even within your own application, right? Does that make sense?
No, it completely does. I mean, it allows you, like it's like you said, it forces you to think about, all right, is this going in the right location? Am I, you know, exposing the correct things? Is this method even going in the right file? Because you're going to start thinking like, well, does this work? And I have a very similar example. I just wrote an extension function 2 days ago for a feature that I was working on. And then I left it in the file and I was about to commit it. And I was looking at my own little personal diff. And I'm like, wait, this kind of would apply to a whole bunch of places. Is this in the right file? It's like, okay, no, it's not. Okay, this file needs to be some. This needs to be in like a shared view folders because it's an extension for some view stuff. And eventually, I ended up moving it into there. And it would have been caught by, you know, thankfully by my teammates who are very good at PR reviews and say, hey, like this needs to be shared. But it does force you to have that internal dialogue with yourself of, all right, are we doing the right thing here?
Right. And I have actually another follow-up question for you. So when you package the features, right, do you also internally keep activity folders, data folder, model folder inside those features? Does that make sense? So for example, if, again, if you have like feature A, feature B, feature C, inside your feature A folder, feature B folder, and feature C folder, do you have subdirectories like activities, model, or something, I don't know, views or like, you know, services? Do you have subfolders within those or do you just chunk them all into like the exact same folder?
For me, I find that most of the time the feature is not so complicated that I'm going to have 100 files in there or more. I'm going to have, you know, maybe a couple of presenters. I'll have a couple of fragments, a couple of activities, maybe a couple of adapters. And it's manageable. And at that point, I'll kind of just throw everything in that feature folder. I think it's one of those things where if I look at the folder and it looks unmanageable, at that point, I might hop in there and reorganize it. But for consistency's sake, I just kind of throw everything inside of one folder at this point, and it's just kind of worked for me at this time. Do you put it into separate folders at all inside of a feature?
No, so that's the thing. That's why I used to try this before, but I've found it to be helpful to just like bunch them all, right? Like if it's a feature, and the way I like to think about it, right? Like if it's growing to the point where I have like 200 classes or something, or like 100 classes in that feature, like at that point, I'm actually conflating multiple features, right? So I probably have to tease that out into like a new feature. So
exactly,
I found that it actually in a weird way enforces like a constraint, right? Like the minute that thing starts to grow really big, I'm like, oh, wait a minute, something's wrong here, right?
It is. That's the best example you can give because it's going to, it's a code smell is what it is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, code smell is like the right word.
And furthermore, I think this also really helps in organizing your tests. And
oh, interesting.
What I mean by that is I'll also, inside of my Espresso test, inside the Android test folder, I will also break apart all of my tests by feature inside of there as well. So it'll mimic the same project structure inside of Android test. So I can know exactly where my tests are at. All the tests are related in there. Now, I may, if I'm doing an Espresso test and it's just an end-to-end type of environment test, I may only have a few files in there and they're just like full end-to-end flow tests. Like, all right, does this feature work if I log in and click these buttons and enter this value? Does this do what I expect it to do? So I may not have 20 files in there. I may only have two or three, but I do know exactly where they're going to be and it matches the structure. And if I'm using a module-based approach, I'll do the same thing. So if I'm packaging by module, And that module actually has a couple features in it for that module, whatever reason. I'll actually package by feature inside of a module. And then that module will also have tests in there that mimic the same form as well. So it allows, if we're testing using modules too, you can just make sure that all of your modules have tests. And then you know as a consumer, hey, this should expect as I expect it to because it has its own tests as well.
Yeah, I love that idea. Mimicking that structure in like the tests folder, what that allows us to do is like, oh, run all the tests for this feature, right? Like, and it sort of like makes it easy to think about it. Like, oh, wait, did I break anything with our order service? Let's just like quickly run the tests on all of like the order service alone, right? So yeah, that is interesting. Again, follow-up question. The end-to-end tests, right? Like this is also something that I find very interesting. We actually have in our testing folder a package called E2E, you know, end-to-end, where we put like all these like sort of like complete flow-like tests. And I'm actually curious to see like what your thoughts are on that. Like how many of those do you have, right? What are your thoughts around that?
So I have seen it done both ways where folks will have the E2E for end-to-end. I'm experimenting, and I can't take credit for this, from one of my current clients. They use the name Flow Test because it's kind of like a user flow or a user journey, meaning that this is the flow that we expect someone to take. And so we'll have perhaps and we use the robot pattern as well, and we can link to the Jake's talk on the robot pattern. And we'll use the robot pattern to allow us to easily kind of write these so it's kind of readable. In regards to how this test should flow. So we'll have maybe one file in there that's a flow test, making sure that the feature does work end to end, because a feature can, and usually will a lot of times, have many activities that's involved with. And so we'll start with that, you know, we'll log in, we'll kind of create these, you know, do whatever needs to happen in the feature, navigate through the activities, verify the expectations, et cetera. And then what we'll also have is we'll have other test files in there for each individual activity. And that one will just kind of test that activity. We'll provide it the inputs that it needs, or whatever. If it's going to be using a network, we'll either mock it out using mock web server, or you can use things like, what's the other one there? WireMock. And return those values so you're not actually hitting an endpoint. So that's how we do it. So you have the end-to-end stuff. Do you only test end-to-end, or do you test the activities as well, or what's your process?
Oh, yeah, no. So what I've recently found myself doing is, like, I'm big on the whole presenter thing. Like, I like using a lot of presenters. And by and large, because of the speed of the tests, I usually like writing way more unit tests, right? Which is also what like actually drove me towards the being like heavy on presenters and like, you know, view models as in like the view, like, you know, I'm saying view models as in the Pojo view models, like not the new architecture components one.
Yep.
And the reason I did that was purely because those run on the JVM and they're faster, right? Try as much as possible to like cover all my test cases, which is why I have a lot of like unit tests and presenter tests. And what I do in the end is like, that's not obviously enough. You've seen many of those memes, right? Where like they say, oh, unit tests all pass, but like, you know, the UI test fails. There are like some funny memes out there. But basically what I do in the end is I try to write a single, but like, you know, overspanning end-to-end test, right? So it'll try to like cover like the happy path of like all of those features that I just built. So at least that just tries to make sure that the presenter is wired up correctly, right? And then I trust the unit tests and the presenters to like test all the edge cases. So if it's at least connected through the screens correctly, then that's like what I usually rely on. So I'll have fewer end-to-end tests. Typically for a feature, I'll have like maybe just one or two end-to-end tests. But then like in my unit test directory, I just go bonkers. Like I just test every single edge case, right? Like it's almost like a spec for me. Like if our PM says like, oh, I need this to happen, I need that to happen, or like our designer says like this should happen and that happens, like I usually try to have unit tests to cover almost everything.
That's I'm glad you bring that up, because I thought we were just talking about the Android test. So that's exactly what I'm doing now with the current client, and it works very, very well. We will have an occasional additional, like I said, we'll have an additional test in there for each activity if there's something pertinent that we do need to test that we just feel it has to be. But kind of the rule of thumb is, if you could test it with the presenter, test it with the presenter, test all that logic to make sure that they were expecting all that's going to happen, and then do the full end-to-end flow test in a big espresso-based test.
Yeah, that just like I found that. And the funny thing is, many people complain that, oh, it takes too much time to write stuff. Like I've actually found that this is an easier sell for me. Because as much as like espresso has made things easy, I've still found like writing an espresso test is like a tad bit slower than writing unit tests, right? Writing unit tests, like I can like just zip through those things, right? Like I know my command, like I know my shortcuts. I write the unit test and I run it and I get immediate feedback. And then I can just like punch through all those test cases, right? So I've actually weirdly found that I'm faster with this approach, right? And also because you have like the safety of unit tests, if I'm like refactoring, which I do a lot when I'm actually building a feature, right? Because at that point, I can't see the structure just yet. So like I try to evolve like the structure of the code as I go along. It's almost like a nice test. The unit tests act like a harness, right?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, this is not something that's new. Like all like books have talked about it. Martin Fowler talks a lot about like the test harness. But like in practice, I found that to work today really well, right? Like, and maybe that's by virtue of the testing framework like having been matured in Android. Like, you know, it's just like works better. Like I found this to be. I can really work with this now. Like, you know, it isn't like an ideal that we dream that will happen one day. Like, I found it to be useful today. So
I agree. I'm at the point now where I will, when I commit a code change, if it doesn't have a test with it, I feel uneasy. And that could be a presenter test or that could be a UI test or whatever, but it has to have something that I can verify, hey, that this change, now I know in the future if something changes in this regard, we'll catch it. Because I'm trying to reduce any of those regressions as much as possible. And it's just confidence is at the end of the day. When you have that huge suite of tests, and I have that right now with the current client, it's just the test suite is massive. It takes a long time to run, but I tell you what, I feel confident after I write my test, I commit it, that it's going to catch anything that I may have messed up.
Yeah. I found it particularly useful in those cases where, like, you know, you have like, I mean, obviously I work at a startup, right? So like, you know, there are last minute changes. Like, we are like, we come back and we're like, oh my God, this needs to change, or like, we need to do this. It's like especially comforting, like when you have to do those quick releases, right? Like, so I can just make a code change and I don't necessarily have the time to sit and test for another 1 hour, like all my cases, right? So I just like run the test suites and I think like, you know, this is relatively a simple change. I don't think I'll be breaking anything. It's nice to have still those test cases saying, yeah, as per our like, sort of like estimates, like you're good, like you're on the clear, right? It's nice to have that, especially in those like crunch time moments when you need to like quickly change something and you don't have the time to sit and like thoroughly test it manually, right?
Yeah, exactly. And but again, I think that's also drives home the point of that end-to-end or that flow testing that we're talking about here is if you have those covering all of your features, or, you know, I mean, hopefully you do. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of us don't. But if you can get to that point, that is such a tremendous relief that you'll find when testing that it's just, you can't be matched. It's hard to match.
Yeah, it's always nice to sort of get an idea of how other folks are doing it. And because I know how you think, it's nice to like hear like how you've been approaching this. So this will be pretty interesting. And I hope folks find this interesting. We'll make sure to drop in more show notes for all the stuff that we sort of touched. And if folks want to find out the other things that you're up to, Don, or like ask more questions, or maybe potentially do a mini Don Felker AMA, what's the best way to do that?
You can reach me on Twitter at Don Felker, or you can email me at my website at donfelker.com. And what about if folks want to get a hold of you, Kaushik?
I'm on Twitter. Kaushik Gopal is my Twitter handle. That's like the easiest way to reach me. And we also have an email address if you're, if you feel like email is a little more safer. contact@fragmentedpodcast.com is the way to reach us. So thank you all for listening. Let us know what you thought about this decompression episode. And yeah, if you have more ideas on other topics that you want us to touch on, let us know. Thank you all for listening.
Thanks.
And before we wind down today's show, I want to take a quick moment and thank our sponsor, Cobiton. Cobiton empowers mobile developers and allows us to run both manual and automated tests, all on real, actual devices in the cloud. Head on over to cobiton.com/fragmented to start a free 15-day trial. Thanks again, Cobiton. That's it for the show, folks. Fragmented is hosted by Don Felker and me, Kaushik Gopal. We edit and produce all the episodes here on Fragmented. Sarah the Amazing Jackson from the Spec Network helps with production assistance and wraps our final mix. Our theme and ad music is by the national recording artist Blueprint from Weightless Recordings. You can find more Fragmented episodes at fragmentedpodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you in the next episode.